Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear listeners. Happy birthday to you.
That's our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, singing. Singing? Happy birthday to you. Terrible singing voice, yeah. But even worse, what he did was against the law. See, Happy Birthday to You is copyrighted, and that copyright is rigorously enforced by its owner, Warner Chappell, a division of Time Warner. You can sing it at home, but in a ballpark or a restaurant or on the radio, it is against the law unless you get permission first. And if you sing the song for commercial or broadcast use, well, then you have to pay royalties as well. Lawrence Lessig thinks this is absurd. He's a law professor at Stanford and one of the leading advocates to change copyright law. He's coined the term remix culture, referring to mashup artists and hip-hop samplers who routinely violate copyright infringement and thus break the law. Steve Paulson caught up with Lessig to talk about remix culture.
Forget music or film for a second. Think just about writing. Nobody thinks when you sit down and write an essay about Hemingway, even quoting works from Hemingway that might still be in copyright, that you've got to contact the Hemingway estate to get permission to quote that work inside of your own work. Everybody understands the freedom to include and to quote is part of the freedom of a society that believes in free expression and creativity. Now, I think what's happening in the context of remix culture is essentially that freedom carried over from text into the space of video and music, because for the first time, technology has democratized those forms of expression in exactly the way the pen or the typewriter democratized writing.
Isn't the crucial question how much you copy, or going back to the writing example, how much you quote?
Well, it's not the crucial question from the perspective of the copyright extremists as they exist right now. They believe any quoting requires permission. There was one case that went to a court of appeals where the basic position was even one note from a recording sampled by a remixer would require permission of the copyright owner. So there's no equivalent conceded by the extremists. They think permission is required for everything. And I think those, you know, from the tradition I'm talking about say that there's a certain balance that has to be permitted if we're going to allow creativity of the past to continue in the future.
Now, on the other hand, there are a lot of hip-hop musicians and mashup artists who don't care at all whether it's legal or not. There's at least one mashup artist who said theft is good for art.
Yeah, I think that people from that perspective are actually buying into the framework of the copyright extremists. You know, when people like Girl Talk or a DJ Danger Mouse make the work that they do, I don't think they're stealing. It's the wrong word. It's not at all what happens, any more than I think that I'm stealing when I quote from Martin Luther King in a lecture I give to my students. What I'm doing is incorporating parts of my culture in a new creative work for the purpose of either criticizing or extending or celebrating or just making reference to the culture around us. That's a kind of freedom we have always had. And I think what's lost in this debate is that this is not a struggle about, you know, new opportunities for people to steal. What's happening here is we're engaged in a battle over new opportunities to control how people speak and create. Never in the history of copyright has copyright tried to exercise such extraordinary control over people's use of culture. This is the first time in our history where the law is purported to regulate absolutely everything a kid does in the creative work under the name of copyright. That's the radical change that's gone on here.
And yet, from the perspective of people in the movie industry and the music industry, there seems to be a whole generation of people out there right now who are breaking the law.
Yeah, that's exactly their perspective. And technically, they're right. According to the way the law's been incorporated, an extraordinary range of how people use computers is now deemed to be illegal. Now, I think this is the real problem. You know, it's like, you know, a war of prohibition that we're engaged in here. And we've told a whole generation that they are criminals, they're pirates, they're felons, according to our law. Now, you know, when you tell a generation that they're criminals, they begin to listen to that. They begin to think to themselves, oh, you know, we're criminals. And that attitude begins to erode their respect for the law in all sorts of other contexts as well. So, you know, we're waging this war against our children, a war my friend, the late Jack Valenti, referred to as his own terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists are our children. And what that war is doing is turning our children into the very criminals that we accuse them of being. But it's not just copyright that's going to suffer here. It's the whole society that begins to be raised under the attitude that the law is something that you don't respect.
Play that out for me a little bit. What do you worry about in terms of how far this might go regarding how young people would break the law?
Well, I think that it's essential, and this is the way, you know, the law has thought about its role for the last 300 years. It's essential that when the law tries to regulate, people buy into the regulation. People in some sense believe in it. You know, so of course there are thieves and there are murderers and there are rapists out there, but most of us believe that the rules there are sensible and we respect them and we actually help to enforce them. When the law tries to reach too far, as it did with prohibition of alcohol, it begins to erode society's respect for the law generally, and it begins to breed a kind of corruption inside of society in all sorts of other contexts. I mean, the greatest problems from prohibition had nothing to do with alcohol. They had to do with the fact that huge swaths of the government became corrupted by the system, and people, you know, worked celebrating the lives of criminals as opposed to celebrating respect for the law. I'm worried that's the same thing that's happening here in our war of prohibition against our kids' use of culture.
Now, you've said that copyright law squelches creativity. Can you give some specific examples of this?
Well, you know, let's be very clear. There are copyright abolitionists out there, people who want to eliminate copyright law. I'm not one of those people. I think copyright law is essential, even in a digital age. But I think that it's radically over-regulating right now. It's regulating all sorts of things that makes no sense for it to be regulating. So one place it's regulating unnecessarily is in the context of remix culture. Now, for example, you can distinguish between professional remixes, you know, the work of Girl Talk or the work of even DJ Spooky or DJ Danger Mouse. You know, let's put that to the side for one second. Let's just focus on amateur remixes. Kid takes a movie like The Matrix, re-edits the trailer, sets it to a music track, and puts it up on YouTube for other kids to share for totally non-commercial reasons. This act of creativity is deemed to be a crime right now. And so if the owners of the Matrix franchise come and say, take that down, YouTube's got to take it down. This kid is a copyright infringer for that act of creativity. Now, I think there is no reason in the world why the law should care about regulating that type of creative activity. Yet it does right now. And what that means is when high schools or colleges think about creating educational programs that try to teach kids how to do this remix, the lawyers come to them and say, you know, you can't do that. You can't teach kids how to do that kind of stuff because that stuff is deemed illegal and we're not going to be encouraging illegal activity here on our campuses. So it not only tells the kid that the kid's a criminal, and of course, you know, most kids would just ignore that. What it does, though, more importantly, is it stifles institutions that should be encouraging this kind of creative expression by telling them that the creativity is illegal, and so therefore they ignore it, and they, you know, tell kids that they should write essays about Hemingway that quote Hemingway and Fitzgerald without, you know, thought about the copyright issues, but they can't make a movie or remix a movie because Hollywood says that that act of creativity is a crime.
Now, you've done something pretty interesting yourself. Your latest book, Code Version 2.0, is actually available free by download under a particular license. Can you explain this?
Yeah, actually now all of my books are available under Creative Commons licenses. The basic license that governs all of them except Code Version 2 says you can download it and share it or remix it or make a derivative from it as long as you're doing it for non-commercial purposes. If you've got a commercial purpose, come talk to me and we'll talk about it. But anything beyond commercial purpose, you're free to do with it. Code Version 2 is actually one step beyond that. That says you can download it and do anything you want with it. If you make a change or a derivative, you just have to release that as freely as you received yours. So in principle, somebody can take Code Version 2 and start publishing it and selling it and not give me a penny. As long as they don't make any changes, they're free to do all of that. consistent with the license that governs it. So it's not just that you can get it for free, it's that it's been licensed in a way that guarantees certain freedoms attached to it.
Let's suppose your vision were to come to happen, that there would be some kind of Creative Commons that that all kinds of musicians and writers and film producers would use, and the copyright laws would be dramatically changed. How would our culture change as well, do you think?
I think what we're seeing is a return to a picture of culture that actually was very much the culture of the 19th century and before. I talk about this extraordinary testimony of John Philip Sousa, where Sousa goes to Congress in 1906 to complain about the talking machines. But in the course of this testimony, he says, when I was a young man, in the summer evenings, the young people would get together and sing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today, you just hear these infernal machines going night and day. We'll not have a vocal cord left, Sousa said. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, Sousa, in that passage, you know, here a professional musician is celebrating the amateur. What he's talking about is the extraordinary importance of young people getting together and singing the songs of the day or the old songs, right? And he's worried that's going to disappear. But that's exactly what has reappeared because of the internet. What we've seen is a culture not so keen in couch potato-like manner to sit there consuming culture produced professionally by others. They're, of course, interested in that professional culture, but they want to do something with it. They want to sing the songs of the day or the old songs. They want to share that singing. But singing now is not using vocal cords. Singing is using digital technologies, remixing, doing different kind of adaptations, and then sharing that with all sorts of their friends. I mean, go to YouTube. YouTube has these extraordinary communities of people taking a particular song, doing a version of it, and then remixing it and sharing it back with each other, usually in a kind of mashup. So there's these great series of mashups, first with Superman as the cartoon, and then with Simpsons as the cartoon, then with Disney as the cartoon. In each of these cases, what the kids are doing is that they're basically taking the culture, remixing it, and sharing it in exactly the way that Sousa was celebrating. And I think that's where we could get again. We could get to a place where people are not just passive consumers, they are creators.
That's Stanford Law Professor Lawrence Lessig in his office in Los Angeles. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Lessig's the founder of the Creative Commons. His book, Code Version 2.0, is available for free at our website under a Creative Commons licensing agreement. Just go to ttbook.org. And while you're there, you can also legally rewrite his book, remix it, and even distribute it if you want.